Our Torah portion this week is called Pinchas. Pinchas. You may know Pinchas better as Phineas. Personally, I like the name Phineas better than Pinchas. And so I will use Phineas throughout the morning. And it begins in Numbers chapter 25, verse 10. Numbers 25, 10. But we're going to back up to the beginning of the chapter, which is part of last week's Torah portion. We did not address this. So I purposely left it off to add it to this week's, because the first half of Phineas' story is in last week's portion, and then the second half of his story is in this week's portion. It seems like an odd place to divide a story. It was divided here for a very specific purpose, and we'll see that in a moment. So let's go back to Numbers chapter 25 and verse 1. It says, Israel settled in Shittim, and the people began to commit harlotry with the daughters of Moab. They, the daughters of Moab, invited the people to the feast of their gods. The people ate and prostrated themselves or worshipped their gods. Israel became attached to Baal Peor, and the wrath of Adonai flared up against Israel. So here's the question. Why did Israel settle in Shittim? They hadn't settled there, this wouldn't have happened. But they did settle there, and this did happen. Why did they settle there? I can wait as long as you can, so I'll just... Anybody have the slightest notion? This is really simple. Now, one of the children could easily tell you why they settled there. Carla. That's where God led them, right? He led them by fire at night, cloud by day. Cloud stopped. They settled in Shittim. It was God's choice, not theirs. But let that sink in for a moment. Because that leads us to another question, doesn't it? If God knew all these horrible things would happen, that they would be seduced by these daughters of Moab to commit false worship and then harlotry with these pagan women, then why did God see fit for them to settle in Shittim? Yes, Dale.
Because everything's a test.
Everything's a test. Very good answer. Everything's a test. And the thing is that they had not been tested and tempted there. How would they ever get strong? Now, just because they're tested there doesn't mean they have to give in to the temptation. You see, there are certain temptations that come our way that are unavoidable. That's guaranteed. In this world, we're going to have testing and temptation, period. And God will give us grace for the ones we must face. Now, the ones you don't have to face, the ones you go and seek out yourselves, the ones you can flee from but don't, God doesn't give you grace for those. You're on your own. You understand? Yes. Go ahead. I was asking myself that same question. Why is it that the Messiah teaches us, Father, lead us not into temptation? Do not lead us into testing. I don't know. Except that somehow the very fact that we're asking him not to means that it's a constant danger and that it is a constant possibility. And also, to not lead us into temptation. You know, here's another thing. You and another person can come into a situation, the exact same situation together at the same time, and one of you is tempted terribly and the other one is not. Which means the difference between the two of you is internal. It's not an external thing, it's an internal thing. Why is it one's tempted and one's not? Maybe one of them's weak is because they've fallen to that before. Now they have an appetite. They've opened a door they should never have opened. Or maybe it's because the other one simply has spent more time in prayer and he's aware that there are temptations and they've already prepared themselves to say no. And that person's been more prepared ahead of time. So I don't know. It's an excellent question. I've been asking that same question myself, praying that no one else would. But it's an excellent question. I'm not quite sure, but it's one I've been chewing on. I invite you to chew on it with me. So he leads them to Shittim. where they could have stood against these temptations, not fallen, and think of the reward, think of the praise from God they would have gotten had they withstood this temptation. But they didn't. They failed. 24,000 are killed. You see, everything that has the potential for reward also has the risk of great damage. We all know that from experience, don't we? But there's something else here, too. It's interesting. The word Shittim, we've come across that word many times before. Here it's the name of a place. But before, it's the name of a tree, or kind of tree. It's a plural word. Anybody remember what Shittim means? It's acacia trees. And we first encounter the word back in Exodus. I forget the exact reference, but back in Exodus, it's first found when God is naming the materials that the tabernacle is to be built from. And all the wood that is used in the tabernacle and in the furniture is Shittim wood. All of it is. So what's interesting here, he leads them to a place called Shittim, which tells me that there's something he wants us to think about. Because the wood that provided all the strength for the things in the tabernacle, for all the posts, all the beams, the walls of the Holy of Holies and the holy place, the wood inside the table of showbread and the altar and the ark, and it's this kind of wood, it's the very heart and substance of the tabernacle, the strength of the tabernacle itself. And it could have been their strength as well had they stood against this temptation. But one of the rabbis has pointed out that the word Shittim is related to the word Shatot. If you look at the word Shatot, which is spelled very similarly, they say it comes from the same root, that the word Shatot in modern Hebrew means foolishness or nonsense. And in ancient Hebrew, it meant insanity. In other words, God led them to a place where they could either become like the heart and soul of the tabernacle itself, strong and a dwelling place for God's presence among them, or they could turn to insanity. And I think that choice lies behind us all the time. It can be a small temptation as to what you're going to watch on TV, what movie you're going to rent, what books you're going to read, what conversations you're going to have. And one leads to strength and increasing God's presence in your life as you become more the tabernacle he wants you to be. While the other leads to insanity, to foolishness, nonsense, and a broken relationship with God. Most of us, we commit spiritual suicide not in one fail blow. We commit it a little at a time. Death by a thousand cuts. But we start, and each one leads further and further from God. On the other hand, our victories can also be little decisions we make, little righteous decisions. I find that life is in the details, and the enemy wants to distract us with big things. I constantly have conversations with other believers, brothers and sisters, and it's always interesting to talk to the ones who've been believers for a short time. You can always recognize something about them. It's their zeal. Oh, they're on fire. Oh, they want some big thing to do for God. And I think, oh, the enemy has so distracted them. He's used their youthful zeal to look for that big thing. Whereas the ones who've been walking with him for more years, for a long period of time, they're not looking for the big thing. They're always focused on the small things. Today, did I have the right conversation with my wife? Did I pray for the and address the things I should have this morning? Did I really spend time in his word? Did I really grasp what he wants to speak to me? Am I walking humbly with him? Am I doing justly? Am I loving mercy? Am I doing the daily things? Did I treat my kids the way I should have today? Those are the things they're focusing on. And you see, it's like my mom used to say when she talked about the economy. This is her advice. She says, if you watch the pennies and the nickels, the dollars will take care of themselves. And that applies spiritually. Watch the little things, the details of your life. And the big things will take care of themselves. God gives me clear instructions about the details of my life and how to live. He gives me no details about the big stuff. It's like he holds that in reserve, and if I'm faithful in that which is small, he'll entrust me with things that are big. But it's his responsibility and his prerogative to give me something big to do if he sees fit. But too often we want to skip the little stuff and go, right, give me something big, Lord, give me something big. And it just doesn't work out well. Well, anyways, look at how the Moabite and Midianite women seduced them. They invited the people to the feasts. First thing is feast. Satan's tactics haven't changed, have they? The way he seduced Adam and Eve was with food. And here we see these women seducing the Israelites with food. And yet we're constantly told in churches that the food laws really aren't important. I think they're extremely important. I think what we put into our bodies, into our temples, is powerfully important. And we need to really pay attention to that. And these are the feasts of their gods. The people ate and prostrated themselves to their gods. Israel became attached to Baal Peor. And the wrath of Adonai flared up against Israel. Adonai said to Moses, take all the leaders of the people, hang them before Adonai against the sun, and the flaring wrath of the Lord will withdraw from Israel. According to Jewish tradition, this is what's being said. Not everyone was completely attached. There were people who weren't. And in a little bit, you'll see where he tells the judges, you know, right here he tells the leaders, the judges is the words used, to go in and begin to execute these people who have committed this spiritual adultery. But how do you know exactly who's doing it? It says, hang them before hang them against the sun. Beshemesh is the word. And what the tradition says is that, you know, they're under the cloud, right? The cloud is what provided shade for the Israelites as they went through the wilderness. And it says what would happen is when people were committing sin, the cloud would open a little hole and light would come through and shine on their tent. And then when they saw that, they knew, okay, in there, there's sin. Over here, there's sin. Those are the people we need to go in and get. And those before the sun. The light would just illuminate it. There it was. According to Jewish tradition, there were 150,000 people who deserved to die that day. 150,000. I won't get into how they arrive at that number, but they say it's an enormous number of people who deserve to die. But one man stood up and did something. Let's see what happens here. Verse 5, Moses said to the judges of Israel, let each man kill his men who are attached to Baal Peor. Behold, a man of the children of Israel came and brought a Midianite woman near to his brothers in the sight of Moses and in the sight of the entire assembly of the children of Israel. And they were weeping at the entrance of the tent of meeting. So get the picture. There's this one man, this one Israelite man, who is so brazen, he brings this one Midianite woman, brings her to the opening to the tabernacle in front of Moses and these people who are weeping over what Israel's doing. Their hearts are broken over the sin that so many of the Israelites have fallen into. And this man takes this woman and right in front of the tabernacle, right at the entrance, begins to commit immorality with her. And then it says, verse 7, Phinehas, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron, Aaron's grandson. Son of Eleazar, son of Aaron the Kohen, saw. He stood up from amid the assembly. He took a romach, a spear in his hand. He followed the Israelite man into the tent and pierced them both, the Israelite woman and the man and the woman into her stomach. Killed them, went right through both of them at the same time into the ground. And the plague was halted from the children of Israel. Those who died in the plague were 24,000. And then the Torah portion ends. You see, what Phinehas did legally was about as wrong as anybody could do. There was no trial. There was no judge. There was no court. This is not the proper way to kill adulterers. They're to be stoned, not pierced with a spear. There was no commandment from Moses to do this. Phinehas acted completely on his own. According to the legal standards and according to the laws, what Phinehas did was completely out of bounds. And I think it's one of the reasons why the Torah portion stops there, because we have to stop there and think, what did this guy just do? He's a priest, for Pete's sake. He is not to be out there running people through with a spear. Priests were not to be involved in warfare. The other 12 tribes were involved in warfare and using weaponry. Not priest. And yet this one man, this is the only second time he's mentioned in the Torah. First time he's mentioned is earlier in Exodus, where it simply gives a family tree. Aaron had a son, Eleazar had a son named Phinehas. That's the only time he's mentioned. He's a nobody. Right? I mean, as far as space in the Torah is given, until this very moment, he stands up and he does this thing. And this is where we're to pause and think about this. Was he angry? It would certainly seem so. And we know that anger leads us very close to the ledge of sin. And when this is why the scriptures say, be angry, but sin not. It never says, be patient and sin not, or be loving and sin not, or be long-suffering and sin not. But it does say, be angry and sin not. Because anger takes you right up to the edge of sin. And it's so easy to go one step further and fall off. Anger is the most caustic and dangerous emotion. Other than unforgiveness, I can't think of anything more destructive than anger. But I would imagine here that Phinehas is pretty angry. Well, let's see what happens. Turn the page, you go to this week's Torah portion, verse 10. Adonai spoke to Moses, saying, Phinehas, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron the Kohen, turned back my wrath from upon the children of Israel. The English just simply does not bring out the essence of what's being said. There's a word here that in Hebrew is the word kana, kof nun aleph. So I'm just use the basic word kana every place where it appears. It says, when he kana kanad. Now your translation may say zealously avenged. Okay? But the word is used twice. When he kana kanad me among them, so I did not consume the children of Israel in my kana. Three times the word is used. God says, I have kana. And he says, and Phinehas had kana for my kana. He zealously avenged my kana. Okay? With kana, he kanaed my kana. And that's how you can put it. Which makes total nonsense in English. But it gives you a little bit of the feel of what's going on in the Hebrew. Therefore say, behold, I give him briti shalom, my covenant of peace. And it shall be for him and his offspring after him a covenant of eternal priesthood, because he took kana for his God, and he atoned for the children of Israel. Now, this passage in Hebrew is very interesting. And some of you who have studied this portion in the past are aware of what is happening here. But that those words, briti shalom, my covenant of peace, are found, here it is. Briti, there's the word briti. Brit is a covenant, briti is my covenant, and there is the word shalom. Now, it doesn't show up very well, but shalom is spelled shin, lamed, vav, mem. And the third letter, the vav there, only in this word, in this verse, only place anywhere in the Bible, that vav is written broken in half. Now, you can barely see it, but it's snapped in half right in the middle. Now, over here is a normal vav. It's just all one solid piece. But here in the word shalom, the vav is broken. And in every Torah scroll in the world, this is the way it's written. Let me show you one that's a close-up of that so you can see it a little more clearly. This is a photograph from our own Torah scroll that we use here during the Torah services. But There you can see the word shalom. Can you see how it's broken right there? Can you see it? The vav comes down, it's snapped, and there's a little light line here. So the question is, the sages ask, why only in this one place in the entire Hebrew Scriptures do we find a vav snapped in half in this word, in this verse, when it comes to God saying, I'll give my covenant of peace, briti shalom, to Phinehas? Why here? Why the vav broken in half? Well, they have different ideas about this. They say one of the things that happens, if you take a vav and you snap it in half, it becomes two letters. The top half of the vav becomes a letter yud, like this. That's a letter yud. And the word yud means hand, all right? So it becomes a picture of a hand holding a spear. That's a possibility. But the letter vav is the sixth letter of the alphabet, sixth the number of man, and a vav is said in Jewish lore to picture a man. And here's a man who's been broken. And they say Phinehas is one who is totally broken before God. Now, I think this is getting closer to the truth. Because the people I know who don't have peace are people I know who have not been broken by the Lord. They've not been broken by Him. And brokenness is something that is extremely important in God's working in our lives. You cannot please Him, you cannot serve Him, you cannot have close, intimate relationship with Him until He breaks you. That's simply the way it is. When Messiah took the bread and the fish that were given to Him, what does it say? He took them, He broke them, and He blessed them. You know, God's blessing, you've got to be broken. It talks about the woman who came and anointed His feet. She had this spikenard, this extremely expensive ointment inside an alabaster box. It says she broke the box, and then the fragrance filled the room. We're all like that box. There's something inside of us, in our spirit, that is precious and wonderful. It's light to the world, but it doesn't get released until we get broken. And this is one of the purposes of pain in our lives, to break us. Because all of us, we're complicated. Because we're fallen, we have inside of us a desire to know God. It's hardwired into the human being. We have a desire to know Him. And if we don't have the light of His Word, we will start to imagine Him in different ways. This is how we have all these different world religions. Okay, they you know, whether it's a primitive religion, they imagine God a certain way, but why do they all have gods of some sort? Because inside of them is hardwired, they want to know God, and if they don't have the word of truth, they'll make up one. And so God wants us to come to Him. But the other problem that comes alongside our desire to know God is this resistance to obey Him. We want to do things our way. We want to do things our way. That's the way we're made naturally, and that's got to be broken. It simply must be broken. Watchman Nee writes about this in a lot of detail. And he says, what generally happens is there's a lot of little breakings in our life. It could be a little thing like dropping a brick on your toe or somebody running into your car, or you're going to the store because you need this one last ingredient for the recipe and they're all out. Or you get there and you realize you don't have enough money in your wallet. Those little irritations, these are God's ways of breaking us. And the question is, how do you respond to those little things? Does it ruin your day? Then you're not broken yet. Or do you say, this is the day the Lord has made, I will rejoice and be glad in it. Do you remember all things work together for good to those who love God and are called according to His purpose? Do you remember to give thanks in all things because it's the will of God concerning you? Do you remember that God runs the world? And it was a small thing for Him to make sure there was mayonnaise on the shelf at the store, but He chose not to have mayonnaise on the shelf at the store right when you needed mayonnaise on the shelf. How do you respond? See, there's a switch inside of you. You're just going to go one way or the other. All right, Lord, well, there must be a reason for this. I don't know what it is. You may choose to show me. You may not. But I'm going to be grateful to you anyway. You see? So we have these little breakings that happen. But somewhere in our life, either early or in the middle or late, maybe a couple times in our lives, there's going to be a major one. Every one of you, if you haven't had it already, you're going to. There's going to be something in your life that's going to absolutely snap you in half. And how you respond to that will determine who you are. It'll determine what kind of person you are. It will determine your walk with God, maybe for eternity. I've seen God break people, and they turn their back on him and never want to serve him again. And they are miserable from that day on to the day they die. I've watched other people broken by God, and they become soft. They're not defensive anymore. And all of a sudden, the unimportant things are unimportant. Their focus is made clear, and they realize the important things are important. And that breaking can come usually through the relationships that are very closest to you. It can be through a spouse. And Robin, in my case, it came through our kids. We thought we were here to raise them, and God used them to raise us in a lot of ways. And we love our kids. They're all great, you know, and they turned out all right in spite of me. But each one, it was a very unique thing. With some people, it can be through their jobs. They'll pour their lives into a career of some sort, and God just pulls it all out from under their feet, and they collapse. It's done. A friend of mine years ago, he's moved out of the state, but he was a very wealthy man, a Jewish man, and a great guy, wonderful guy. Great business, in partner with another guy. And the other guy stole the entire business, all the money, everything, and just left him out to hang. And, you know, he pursued different legal means to try to get redress on this. Nothing worked. And he was basically left penniless. He was a broken man. So how you respond to that is going to determine who you are. And so when we look at this one letter in this one word in this one place in the Torah, the word shalom, where God gives to Phinehas his covenant of peace, briti shalom, the letter vav is snapped in half. Every Torah scroll in the world is exactly that way right there. Now, for years, I come to this Torah portion, and I wrestle with this thing. What was it about Phinehas? What is with this guy? He does everything that appears to be wrong. In anger, he kills two people. No court, no jury, no defense attorney, no judges involved. He's a priest. He's not supposed to be holding weaponry and killing people. And he does everything contrary to what you expect of a priest. Yet God takes this man, and it's almost like God is totally distracted from killing off Israelites. And look at this. Here's somebody who gets it. Here's someone whose heart is exactly in sync with mine. And it even says that he atoned for Israel by killing these two rotten individuals. And the death stopped at that point. Boom. One rabbi puts it this way. It says here, this is Rabbi Nachman, Nachmanides. He says, the sinners deserving death were many, but Phinehas' action, in fact, saved them, and they were not killed. And accordingly, many of those who were attached to Baal Peor remained alive at this point. This man who brought death was a savior of Israel. This broken man. And I've tried to get inside, I'm no Phinehas, but I've tried to get inside of Phinehas' head. And I want to share something with you that I can't prove theologically, I can't prove it from the scriptures. It's just this thing, this notion I've got inside my heart as I think about Phinehas. Somehow when I think of this, and I've read it over and over and over, and just ponder it and meditate on it, I think, stick to my opinion, toss it out, you don't have to agree with anything. But I think that there was something in Phinehas that at that point, he was so heartbroken for his people that his grief for the sin of Israel was just about the same as God's grief for the sin of Israel. And his hatred for what he saw them doing was as strong as God's hatred, because God says he had wrath, he had anger. And it's as if in that moment, Phinehas totally lost himself, but he wasn't given over to anger, because the anger of man does not work the righteousness of God. Simply does not. But it wasn't the anger of man. It's almost as if at that moment, Phinehas set himself completely aside. It was not about Phinehas. It had nothing to do with him. It was all about God and his love for his people and the anger it caused him to see them committing this spiritual adultery against him. And for that split second, for that one moment that it took to get a spear and just kill these two, Phinehas was completely, completely caught up with God. I just somehow think that's the case. And it so, I don't know the word, I don't think God's ever shocked or surprised, but it's just so, boom. It's just like this one act by this one man was so enormous in the spiritual realm and in God's mind that everything stopped. There's something here that tells me that one small act by one small man can be huge in the spiritual realm. That little things in the physical realm are huge in the spiritual. Whereas huge things in the physical realm don't even make a blip on the screen in the spiritual. But little things. I'll tell you a little thing that made the biggest blip of all. That's the death of Messiah. It happened in this one little tiny country in the city of Jerusalem. This backwater nation that's on the outskirts of the Roman Empire. That no other history books really acknowledge. And this one man, a carpenter from Nazareth, he's executed. What's new? Romans are executing people all the time. But this one is the biggest event the world's ever seen. The spiritual realm, nothing bigger. It was a spiritual atomic bomb. Atomic, coming from the word atom. It was an atom. Boom. It was tiny, but enormous. Now, something else has come to light this week as I was looking at this. I did a search to see if there's any place else in the Bible where that phrase, Briti Shalom, my covenant of peace, is found. And lo and behold, it's found four times in the Bible. Now, this is the first, right here in Numbers 25. But it's found three times over in the prophets, once in Isaiah and twice in Ezekiel. So I went over to look at those. I'm going to read the Ezekiel passages first. You can just jot down the references and check them out later if you want. Ezekiel 34:25. This is what God says. I will make with them, with Israel, a covenant of peace and banish wild beasts from the land so that they may dwell securely in the wilderness and sleep in the woods. And then a few chapters later, Ezekiel 37:26-28, I'll read. I will make a Brit Shalom with them, a covenant of peace. It shall be an everlasting covenant with them. And I will set them in their land and multiply them, and will set my sanctuary in their midst forever. My dwelling place shall be with them, and I will be their God. They shall be my people. Then the nations will know that I am Adonai, who sanctifies Israel, when my sanctuary is in their midst forever. So, these two passages in Ezekiel and also the one in Isaiah we'll look at all have to do with the future, with God establishing his covenant of peace with the nation. But it's future yet. Not now, it's in the future with a nation. But here in Numbers, he has established it with an individual. That's very unique. And when we go to the Isaiah 54 reference. I do invite you to turn in your Bibles to Isaiah 54. So we're going to read a more extended passage. What an amazing chapter this is. Love this chapter. Isaiah 54. As we read through this, I want you to be thinking about the events of Numbers. See if you see correspondences. Isaiah 54, we'll start with the first verse. Shout for joy, O barren one, you who have borne no child. Break forth into joyful shouting and cry aloud, you who have not travailed. Referring to travail of childbirth, of birth pains. For the sons of the desolate one will be more numerous than the sons of the married woman, says Adonai. Enlarge the place of your tent. Stretch out the curtains of your dwelling. Spare not. Lengthen your cords. Strengthen your pegs. In other words, you're going to need a big house for all the kids you're going to have. For you will spread abroad to the right and to the left, and your descendants will possess nations and will resettle the desolate cities. Fear not, for you will not be put to shame. Do not feel humiliated, for you will not be disgraced. But you will forget the shame of your youth. You see, in the Torah, as we see Israel going through the wilderness, and then in Joshua and Judges, we see them settle the land, they're still in their youth. They're in their adolescence. That's why they're always goofing up. That was their stupid teen years, I guess you could say. But here, God is prophesying their adulthood. And it says, you will forget the shame of your youth. And the reproach of your widowhood, you will remember no more. For your husband is your maker, whose name is Adonai of hosts, Adonai Zevaot. And your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel, who is called the God of all the earth. Do you notice the first half of verse 5, it's the spiritual. Your husband is your maker, his name is Adonai of hosts. And then the second half is earthly. Your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel, who is called the God of all the earth. For Adonai has called you like a wife forsaken and grieved in spirit, even like a wife of one's youth when she is rejected, says your God. For a brief moment, I forsook you. You know, people say God's turned his back on Israel. He did for a brief moment, just for a short period of time. In other words, he took them and snapped them in half. He made a separation. For a brief moment, I forsook you, but with great compassion, I will gather you in. In an outburst of anger, I hid my face from you for a moment. But with everlasting loving kindness, I will have compassion on you, says Adonai, your Redeemer. For this is like the days of Noah to me, when I swore that the waters of Noah would not flood the earth again. So I have sworn that I will not be angry with you, nor will I rebuke you. Now he has been angry, and he has rebuked, but he says, day's coming when that's all past. It will not happen again. Just as I made a promise to the earth in the days of Noah, I've never destroyed the earth with a flood. I'm making a promise to you, the day's coming when I will never be angry with you again, never rebuke you again. Verse 10, for the mountains may be removed, and the hills may shake, but my loving kindness will not be removed from you. And Briti Shalom, my covenant of peace will not be shaken, says Adonai, who has compassion on you. And he goes on, O afflicted one, storm-tossed, not comforted, behold, I will set your stones in antimony and your foundations lay in sapphires. And he goes on, it's a wonderful chapter. Do you see the connection? Because if there's ever a time where you see just a blatant disregard for God, blatant spiritual adultery. This is worse to me than the sin of the golden calf. No, at the sin of the golden calf, only 3,000 died. Here, 24,000 died, and many more deserve to die. See, the golden calf happened very early in Israel's history after they had left Egypt. And they were slave mentality. They didn't know much about God. And Moses is up on the mountain. He wasn't there to control things. And Joshua had gone halfway up the mountain with him. So Joshua isn't there. They're kind of left leaderless for 40 days. And it took 40 days. But finally, they kind of fell into this whole golden calf thing. So yeah, 3,000 died. But this is 40 years later here in Numbers. This is after they've heard God speak from Mount Sinai. They've seen what happens to people who sin. They've seen what happened to the golden calf. They've seen what happens when people rebel against God's anointed leaders. And Moses is right there. He hasn't left. They have the Torah. They've entered into a covenant with God. And this time they sin, and it's even more blatant than with the golden calf. This is a much more serious act. I want to talk about Phinehas a little bit more. As I look into what Jewish tradition says about Phinehas, it comes up with some pretty interesting things. Now, first of all, the broken vav. You understand my insight on that? I think what that broken vav is picturing is that in Phinehas, what he did with an individual is a picture of what he's going to do with a nation, but the nation has to be broken first. They have to be broken first. And Israel has been going through a brokenness, which God calls a short period of time, this short forsaking. But in the in picture, in the context of eternity, it's just a blip. It's just very small. Yes, Rosemary. The sin of the flesh, is as bad as that is, I'm not disagreeing with that. What was even worse was the spiritual adultery. By turning their back on the God who, there was this cloud covering them. I mean, he provides manna every morning. And turning their back on this God who's so close to them to follow Baal Peor because they're seduced away by these women to worship their gods. It was the spiritual counterpart. It was the forsaking of God. No, people, and I don't condone sexual sin in whatever shape or form. I mean, sin is sin is sin. But just someone who falls sexually, I have more tolerance. I have more mercy towards them and understanding. But someone who just turns their back on a God who's been so, who's answered prayers, who's walked with them, who they've known, has turned their back on him, that I just don't get. I just don't get it. But here you find the two mixed together. So, but here's something interesting about Phinehas. God, when he talks, he talks about, I'm going to give you this as an eternal covenant to him, an eternal priesthood. How can you make an eternal priesthood with a man who's only going to live 70 years or so, then die? But Phinehas lived an incredibly long life. We don't even know how long he lived. Because you see, his birth is recorded, but his death isn't. And as you go through the Torah, you find Phinehas there. And as you go through the book of Joshua, you find Phinehas there as the high priest. As you go through the book of Judges, guess who you continue to see as the high priest? Phinehas. You get to almost to the end. Judges, I think, is 22 chapters long. You get to Judges chapter 20. This is almost 400 years later after this event. And Phinehas is still high priest. Judges 20, 28. Phinehas is still high priest, we see there. Here's what the passage says. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, son of Aaron, in other words, it's not some other guy named Phinehas, it's this same Phinehas, ministered before it in those days, saying, shall we go out once more to battle against our brothers, the people of Benjamin, or shall we cease? And Adonai said, go up, for tomorrow I will give them into your hand. It's talking about that event in chapter 20 of Judges, almost 400 years later after the book of Numbers. And Phinehas is still high priest, this same Phinehas. And there's no record of his death. And then this Phinehas is in some Jewish legends, and I'm not saying this is the case, but according to Jewish legend tradition, Phinehas and Elijah are the same person. Because with Elijah, you have no record of his birth. And what happens at the end? He's caught up into heaven on the fiery chariot. And in the Orthodox Jewish mindset, that same Elijah the Tishbite, is also Phinehas, the high priest. Just a thought. You know, am I saying it's the case? No, not at all. Philo, the ancient Jewish historian, states that Phinehas ascended physically into heaven, just as Enoch and Elijah did. He doesn't say he is Elijah, but he ascended physically into heaven. Who knows? See, here's a great mystery. You know, people ask you sometimes, who's the person you want to meet in heaven? Which Bible character? And some will say, oh, I want to meet David, or I want to meet Moses, I want to meet Abraham, and I say all the above. But I've added Phinehas to that list. He's right there in the top 10. Because there's enough here just to tease you into thinking, I want to know who this guy is. Because he has a powerful impact upon the people of Israel. Even though he's mentioned only in this, any real detail right here in this event, he does this terribly violent thing. And yet God rewards him in an incredible way, unusual way, that you don't see happening with anybody else. It's a pretty amazing thing. Robin, did I see your hand up? Yes, what was broken in him was that the ego. One rabbi I read this week describes Phinehas' deed as anger without ego. And I thought, wow, where do you ever see that? I see it twice in the scriptures. I see it with Phinehas, who had anger with no ego. There's nothing about him in it. And I see it with Yeshua, when he goes to the temple two times, premeditatedly makes a whip of cords. He knows exactly what he's going to do. Now, I don't think he did with a smile on his face and say, sorry, guys, I don't mean to have to hit you, but I have to do this. I don't think he did that. He was turning tables over. Money was rolling around on the floor. And he's driving these money changers out of the temple. And he says, you know, it's supposed to be a house of prayer. You've turned it into a den of thieves. And when you read about that in John, John quotes Psalm 69:9 as a prophecy applying to Yeshua, where it says there, for zeal for your house has consumed me, and the reproaches of those who reproach you have fallen on me. You know what the word for zeal is there? Kana. Same word that's used of Phinehas. So, kind of interesting. Well, let's go on a bit. When you, it goes on to tell the names of these people. In verse 14, Numbers 25:14, the name of the slain Israelite man who was slain was with the Midianitis was Zimri, son of Salu. Zimri means my song. A zimmer is a song. Some of the psalms are called Zimrot. My song. Leader of a father's house of the Simeonites. And the name of the slain Midianite woman was Cosby. No relation to Bill. Cosby, which means my lie, my deception. Now get the picture. Here's my song. Here's what Zimri's life was meant to be, a song to the Lord. But instead, he had attached it, descended to my deception, and poured himself into a lie. What a graphic picture, if there ever was one. And one of the things, the sages say, well, why is it Moses didn't act? I mean, he's right there. Why was he just still? And they say because this was a Midianite woman. And Moses' wife was what? A Midianite. You see? It's almost like Moses wants to do this, but he's married to a Midianite. Zipporah is a Midianite. But she was not, I mean, she wasn't like this, but she was not a sinful woman, as this one was. But it's almost like he's mocking Moses. Look, you can't say anything, it's me. You married a Midianite? Well, I've got a Midianite too. So let's move on. Verse 16, Adonai spoke to Moses saying, harass the Midianites and smite them. And notice he doesn't say the Moabites, just the Midianites. Why does he say just the Midianites, not the Moabites? First of all, Moab was a close relationship to Israel. The Moabites were descendants from Lot, Abraham's nephew. And also the sages tell us that whereas the Moabites, as you go through and kind of piece it together, you can see leading up to this, the Moabites were very afraid of Israel. But Midian, on the other hand, was filled with hatred of Israel. So the Moabites operated out of fear, but Midianites operated out of hatred. And that's why God says, the Midianites, you go after them. And we'll read about that battle in a Torah portion to come. For they harassed you through their conspiracy, and they conspired against you in the matter of Peor and in the matter of Cosby, daughter of a leader of Midian, their sister, who was slain on the day of the plague in the matter of Peor. And then You're all ready for the battle, right? And what does he do? He does a census. It's like, come on. Who puts a census right here where you're getting ready to go into a big battle? Well, one of the things that's interesting for the census, you have to go back to verse 1. And it does not appear in the English, but if you have a Hebrew Bible, if you look over across the page of the Hebrew, this is what you find. With verse 1, in Hebrew it says, Vayhi achrei hamagefa. It was after the plague. And then it goes to a new paragraph. Right? So you've got three words. Vayhi achrei hamagefa. And then it skips and goes down to the next line, just leaves blank space, starts a brand new paragraph. And the sages say, why do you start a paragraph there? In English, it reads smoothly. It was after the plague, the Lord spoke to Moses, Eleazar, son of Aaron, the Kohen, saying, take a census. You don't put a paragraph break, right? It was after the plague, next paragraph. The Lord spoke to Moses. Why put a paragraph break there? And the sages say it's for this reason. After this plague, after the 24,000 are killed, God has done killing off Israelites before going into the promised land. It's done. During those 40 years, there's a lot of birth and a lot of death. And as the old generation dies, the new generation is born to take their place. And after this whole deal with Baal Peor, the death part's over. It's a new paragraph. We're going to take a new census now because these people were counting. Were the ones who are 20 years old and younger or not even born yet when they left Egypt. This is the new generation. This is the new count. These are the ones who are going in. The census back in the first of Numbers, those are the ones who came out. This census at the end of Numbers, these are the ones going in. And when you go through and you compare the numbers from chapter 1 to this chapter, you find some tribes had a dramatic drop-off. The tribe of Simeon lost over 37,000 people. Their numbers are that much lower in the census. Others gained thousands. But when you count them up, the numbers are just about the same. They're pretty close. So for every death, there seems to have been a birth. This is a picture of us. Because the people of Israel are a picture of each person here. And the story of the nation of Israel is a story of you and me. And every one of us, though you may never have been to Africa or visited Egypt, every one of us was in slavery under a Pharaoh making bricks for his glory. And then later even took the straw away, even took the pleasure out of the brick making. And we have a Redeemer who has brought us out by the blood of the Lamb, from death to life, from slavery to freedom. We've experienced that. And this place of the wilderness is a place of pain and of death and of life. And the old has to die and be buried in the wilderness, and the new has to grow up, because that's what goes in the promised land. I want to show you something. I see the clocks. I think Dale's back there messing with the hands. But I want you to skip over to chapter 26, verse 52. I want to show you just two quick things. Then we'll take a few questions. Chapter 26, verse 52. Adonai spoke to Moses, saying, to thee shall the land be divided as an inheritance. Okay, he's taken the census. He says, to these shall the land be divided as an inheritance, according to the number of names. For the numerous one you shall increase its inheritance. For the fewer one, you shall lessen its inheritance. There's a powerful, powerful lesson here for us. It's this. Your inheritance in the land is based upon your obedience in the wilderness. Your inheritance in the land is based upon your obedience in the wilderness. Those tribes, like the tribe of Simeon, who were bent towards rebellion, their numbers decreased dramatically, so they get a smaller inheritance in the land. Those other ones, like Ephraim, they just went off the charts. They were obedient. They stayed close to God. Their numbers increased, so their inheritance of the land is huge. But your inheritance of the land is based upon your obedience in the wilderness. This place of transition, this place of pain. And I say, don't get used to the pain. The wilderness is a painful place. This world's a painful place. I don't say get used to it. Because once you get used to the pain doesn't do you any good anymore. Don't get used to the pain here. Let it have its purifying, perfect work in your life. Don't seek it out. But when pain comes into your life, realize it comes from the hand of God. That pain, though it's painful, does not necessarily mean it's bad. Some of the most wicked things in your life are the things that don't feel painful. Some of the best things in your life are the things that are. Okay? We equate pleasure with good and pain with bad. That's nonsense. Okay? That's nonsense. You can't measure good by whether it's painful or not, or bad whether it's painful or not. I want to show you one last thing in this chapter that's, I almost missed it going through this time, but I want to share it with you. We see in verse 65, for Adonai had said to them, they will surely die in the wilderness, you know, this older generation, and not a man was left of them except for Caleb, son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, son of Nun. And then we see Joshua receiving a special recognition, a special gift. And that's going to be over in chapter, let me find it here. In chapter 27, I want you to notice something. Verse 18, Adonai said to Moses, take to yourself Joshua, son of Nun, a man in whom there is spirit. Okay, you see that? And lean your hand upon him. You shall stand him before Eleazar the Kohen and before the entire assembly and command him before their eyes. You shall place some of your hod, your majesty, glory upon him, so that the entire assembly of Israel will hear. Now make sure we hear what's being said. Take to yourself Joshua, son of Nun, a man in whom there is spirit. You see, back in chapter 13, verse 16, Moses changes Joshua's name. He changes it from Hoshea to Yahashua. He just adds a letter. He takes the letter He and puts it in Joshua's name. So Hoshea becomes Yahashua. All right? I'm sorry, adds the letter Yud. I'm thinking of somebody. He adds the letter Yud. Yud, which is always represents God's spirit. Okay? I should never go by memory. It always fails me. He adds a Yud to his name. So Hoshea becomes Yahashua. All right? He adds the Yud. Yud is that little tiny letter, only one that's suspended up in space. And as you know it, it always represents God's spirit. It's the first letter of God's name, Yud Heh Vav Heh. It's the first name of Yisrael and of Yeshua and so many names. And it represents God's spirit, God's hand. So he added that to Joshua's name way back earlier. And here God says, a man in whom there is spirit. But here he says now, Moses is about to die. Your replacement is Joshua. What I want you to do is lay your hands on him and place your hod, your majesty, your glory on him. Why? So that the entire assembly of Israel will hear him. Yeshua's name is the same as Joshua's name. When Yeshua first came to earth, he came with the Spirit of God. He was in an earthen vessel. There's nothing special about his physical appearance. But he was a man totally, absolutely saturated with the Spirit of God. Sinless. The Word made flesh. Some heard, most didn't. But he's going to return. And when he comes back, he'll not just come back with the Spirit of God, but with the glory of God. You follow? Why? Because then now everyone will hear him. You know, when Moses came down from Mount Sinai the first time, he just came down with the tablets. And he came down to a sinful Israel, the tablets are broken. He had spent 40 days and nights in God's presence, just filled with God's, his spirit, his presence. And he sees the sin about him and the tablets are just broken to pieces. That's a picture of Yeshua just being broken. So then later he goes away again. The second time he came down with the 10 tablets. the Ten Commandments on the two tablets. This time Moses' face just glowed. It was so bright that people had a hard time looking. We had to wear a mask just to mask the glow that was on his face. This is a picture of Moses' return. It's a picture of Yeshua's return. You understand? And this time he comes back to Israel waiting for him. As the Talmud says, they're trying to figure out what will the people of Israel be like when Messiah comes? Because we look at some places where it looks like they reject the Messiah, and over here it looks like they receive the Messiah. What's going on? And the Talmud tells us that the Messiah will come either to the most wicked generation of Israel ever in their history, or he'll come to the most righteous generation of Israel. Well, we know the truth. The first time he came to the most wicked generation. They were so wicked they couldn't even recognize the Torah when it walked among them and talked. And they executed him. Hatred without a cause is what Yeshua calls it, and that's what the Talmud calls it. Why was the first temple destroyed? Or why was the second temple destroyed, Herod's temple? The Talmud says, hatred without a cause. And Messiah says, they have hated me without a cause. But when he returns, I see God working today in Israel to prepare people who are looking for their Messiah. Be prepared for him. And I think we're part of that work. It's an exciting time to be alive. So anyways, this Torah portion, if I feel frustrated, it's because I'm frustrated. There's so much here to talk about, so much good stuff packed in here. And I swear, when I sit down to talk, those hands on the clock look like a fan. So, anyways, we're going to close in prayer so we don't go too far over time. But I invite you to come down to Oneg Room. We can talk as much as you want about these things. Father, thank you for this portion of your Torah. Lord, thank you for the life of Phinehas, for in him we see Messiah in so many ways. And Lord, in Phinehas, we see who we hope to be. For Lord, there are things when you call us to be angry that we need to be angry about. But Lord, help us to be angry without ego. Lord, help us to be so caught up with you that we just simply are your people. But Lord, I pray you'd protect us from trying to imitate Phinehas so that we take on some kind of a false hypocritical anger that's based entirely on Phinehas. We go around destroying things around us saying, I'm a Phinehas. Lord, protect us from that stupid foolishness. Because Lord, we're not a Phinehas. Not yet. But Lord, help us to be more of the people who aren't trying to defend our own ways, but Lord, just to defend yours. It's not about us, it's all about you. It's not self-preservation we're concerned with. For Lord, I'm sure Phinehas, when he did what he did, he just figured his life was over too. He was ready just to die. Lord, help us to be people who are not only ready to die, but daily we take up our crosses and follow you. We deny our rights to ourselves. We're yours. Help us to be faithful to follow you in that way, to be living sacrifices. And Lord, as you break us, as you broke Jacob when you wrestled with him at the Jabbok Brook, and after he realized who he was wrestling with, it wasn't his enemy, it was his God. It says his hip was out of joint, he walked with a limp. He was broken. So Lord, I pray you do the breaking that every one of us needs, but give us the grace that as the external is broken, that the internal becomes strong and beautiful and fragrant and bright to accomplish and do great things in this world that we can't even imagine or nor even be aware of when they're happening. Lord, just make us your people, the people you want us to be. We ask in Yeshua's name. Amen.